I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Robert Stevens, the founder and chief inspector of Geek Squad, a company that provides computer and entertainment center tech support for consumers and small businesses. Robert started the company in 1994 while he was still a college student at the University of Minnesota, and Geek Squad was bought by the consumer electronics giant Best Buy in 2002. Welcome.
Thank you.
You grew up in the Chicago area, and you were the youngest of seven children?
I was the youngest of seven, but by the time I was born, almost all my brothers and sisters were nearing, you know, getting out of high school. So I was almost an only child, so I kind of had both. Big family, but I had most of the house to myself.
What did your parents do?
My father was in the Navy 20 years, and then he worked at Allstate 20 years as a systems analyst. So my mother was a stay-at-home mom. You know, my father was, you know, probably could have gone farther in his career, but, you know, the family was a priority. So he was a 9-to-5er. He was home at 5. And, I mean, I don't ever remember a day going home after school and not having, you know, my parents there. Mm. So very Huckleberry Finn existence that I'm doing my best to duplicate for my children.
Well, what was your ambition growing up? Did you think, okay, I want to be a successful entrepreneur, or I want to be, what was going through your mind as to what you wanted to do?
When I look back, I was always a troubleshooter and taking things apart. I mean, I come from a long line of troubleshooters. You know, my brothers were very blue-collar bricklayers and mechanics, so we were very hands-on people. And my brother, who's, you know, 11 years older than I am, was a mechanic as a teenager. So every night he used to bring carburetors home, you know, for Volkswagen Beetles that were at the shop where he worked, because I love to take things apart. So he'd pay me a buck to rebuild carburetors. So while everybody was sitting around the TV after dinner watching TV, I'd be sitting there at the coffee table with a screwdriver taking carburetors apart. That just became a lifelong love of disassembling things. I've spent the rest of my life learning how to reassemble them.
Uh-huh. What were some of the jobs you held prior to starting Geek Squad?
Well, I've actually only held like four jobs my entire life, including my current job at Geek Squad. The first paid job I ever got was a rock climbing instructor in Canada.
What were some other jobs?
The second job I ever held was for the Verlo Mattress Factory in Wheeling, Illinois, the town where I grew up. You'd walk in, there'd be a small showroom, you're going to go buy a bed. And so when somebody walks in the store, you put the stapler gun down and walk out there and dust off the cotton and you sell a product. And I was pretty good at sales. And I had like blue combat boots and spiked hair and I was the top salesperson. So if you can look like that and sell pretty well, you just kind of realize, you know, what you're good at.
Now, how did the idea for making house calls, fixing people's computers, originate while you were at the University of Minnesota?
Well, at that time, remember, in the early 1990s, this is when kind of the technology shift began to happen. I mean, Michael Dell, I think, was just coming out of college. Bill Gates was about to become the world's richest person. At that time, you know, dial-up internet access first emerged. And that's when computers started to become useful, when they could talk to each other. And you know, the first web browser was being developed. Mark Andreessen, who had found Netscape, was still a student at the University of Illinois. And so all these great things were going on. And my roommate worked in this research lab. And he took me there one day, and I saw the internet for the first time. So I started working there. But to pay for school, I had to start make extra money. So I started making house calls on my mountain bike and a cell phone, you know, just fixing PC problems.
How did you let people know that you were in business to make those house calls?
Well, just word of mouth. I mean, that's why service is so bad in any part of the world, because it's easy to get into the service business. I mean, if you can do something technically and you have a cell phone and you have a few friends and you start doing work for them, word will spread. If you're good, you get a lot of phone calls. But that's also part of the problem. We've all called a drywall contractor or plumber. They don't return phone calls. They don't show up when they're supposed to. They either smell bad and talk down to you or all of the above. And so when I started showing up, I kept hearing these things. Oh, that other person fixed my computer problem, but they, you know, they wouldn't show me how they fixed it. Or they didn't ever call me back. Or they were rude. And I thought, well, there's really what you're paying me to do, remove that virus or get that file back. But then there's also the other things, like showing up and taking my shoes off without being asked. And if you don't have any money for advertising, those little details add up, and that they all become your advertising. And then I realized, going, here I am in a really unglamorous, low-end business like computer repair that's not full of any creative people at all. And I consider myself a pretty creative person. What if a creative person went into a boring business? So my goal wasn't to stay in computer repair. It was to grow it as kind of like a fast food business to eventually get into the gourmet food business, high-end computer consulting. But I found those, all the creative and beautiful and smart people went into high-end consulting, and nobody wanted to deal with this massive volume of people who need help.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Stevens, founder of Geek Squad, a company that provides computer and electronics tech support to consumers and small businesses. Robert started Geek Squad in 1994 when he was 24 years old, and the company was sold to Best Buy in 2002. Geek Squad now has over $1 billion in sales and 20,000 employees. Geek Squad has a law enforcement police aesthetic, and that's kind of cheeky and nostalgic. Now, the image of the company has become just as important or as visible as the actual service that you're providing. Did you start thinking about the image of the company simultaneously at the very beginning, or did it take some time for you to start thinking about these image issues?
No, I did it right from the very beginning. I tell people the best thing ever to happen to me when I started my company is I had no money. Because if you have money, you're going to hire a PR firm. Mm-hmm. People would always ask me, who's your PR firm? I don't have one. Who did all your branding? I did. Who does your accounting? I do. I mean, when you have to do everything yourself, you tend to appreciate it more. You get more creative. And, you know, when you're not spending a lot of money, you're not borrowing money, then you're taking more chances because what have you got to lose?
How did you come up with this law enforcement vibe?
Well, from the customers, because I would show up and it was just like, I was watching Dragnet one night, you know, Dragnet, the TV show from the 60s, you know, with Joe Friday, and they show up, you know, the police car pulls up and there's a frantic person at home, who, you know, and a crime's been committed and they have to investigate. That's so exactly like a house call. I show up and you're all freaked out and you're like, it's over there. It won't behave. You know, like step away from the computer, ma'am. And I saw a lot of parallels and I thought, instead of trying to teach people about this service that they've never experienced before, so they have no context, I'm going to use analogies they already have in their head. Mm-hmm. You know what? And so I didn't have any money for marketing, and it's important to be memorable. Now, if we didn't show up 5 minutes early for every appointment and we didn't do great service, this would all be a shtick and a gimmick.
In fact, you're dressed like a Geek Squad agent right now. You have a clip-on black tie with a little Geek Squad pin, and you have very white socks and black shoes. Why do you stipulate that all of your employees wear white socks?
There are two reasons most people don't know that I will reveal them now for the first time because nobody's ever bothered to ask. The two reasons we have them wear them, one is they have to be white. We give them a white card and we say, if your socks fail to match this color, it's time to change your socks. So actually the white is color coding. The other reason is it's a visual indicator. If you can't see the white socks in the customer's home, you have forgotten to take your shoes off. So it's actually a reminder. A stark reminder. So in a way, we're a mix of Dragnet, but we're also a hybrid of Ghostbusters. You know, we're a bit memorable, but we do charge for what we do, unlike the police. We're like NASA. The uniform came from NASA because I was looking for a uniform. My first uniform was SWAT, because that was one of my favorite shows in the 70s, the black vans. And I'd fix this ice cream company's computers, and so they couldn't pay their bill. And I said, I'll take two of your ice cream trucks, and I painted them black. Because I was one of my own SWAT truck. So then I put people in black jumpsuits with black combat boots and black like fanny packs that could whip out a floppy disk in a moment's notice. But the problem is it scared the crap out of customers when we showed up. So it's important to be creative, but you also have to know kind of when to tone it down. So then Apollo 13 came out in 96, and I'm sitting there in the theater watching this, and it brought back all these memories of the scenes of Mission Control during the Apollo launch when we watched science films in class. And I always thought that NASA was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. NASA is the ultimate symbol for teamwork, problem solving, doing the impossible, you know, together as a group. And I thought, oh my God, they're wearing a uniform and they don't even know it. They wear short sleeves. But there's a functional reason they do it, and same reason for us, only ours is for ventilation because the underarm areas tend to be a bit of a problem for hygiene. And the last thing I was going to do is bring another damn polo shirt into the world. So if you look at the dress, it's very basic, black and white. In 100 years, this uniform will become part of American culture, I believe. Now, there's only one other group of people that dress like us.
Who?
And, well, the Mormons. Now, one of two things are going to happen. Because people always think I'm going to hand them a Bible when they see us on the street. One or two things will happen. Either in the next couple of years, the Mormons are either going to have to change their uniform or we're going to have to teach them how to fix computers.
Did you ever face any backlash? I mean, you came up with this idea before America invaded Iraq. And, you know, your employees are called cadets and covert operators and CIA seniors. I'm wondering if this image at all, if this mentality took on a different meaning after the war started.
No, because we don't really play, you know, when you hear about our titles, like our, you know, the reason we call them counterintelligence agents, because they actually work at the counters inside of Best Buy stores. So there is a bit of functional relevance there. But, you know, we don't really use the titles in advertising. Behind the scenes, a lot of this marketing is not really for the public. It's really for the agent.
To be fair, there was a blogger on consumeractivist.com, and I thought what he said was kind of funny. You won't think it's funny, but he said, the whole super spy show they put on is pathetic. Just do the damn job and play secret agent in your spare time. What's your response to that?
Well, we're used to being picked on. So let's break that sentence down. They should just do their jobs. That's like saying all cars should be the same. It will be more fuel efficient. All coats should be the same. We can produce them cheaper and we won't waste any expensive fabric. Mm-hmm. No company should have any style or personality. That's completely ridiculous. Now, he does make a good point. If we don't show up on time and if we don't do the best service, then this all becomes a very pathetic joke.
I want to talk to about some of the creative, resourceful things you did in the early days pertaining to marketing, because you seem to get your look right. But how did you go about spreading the word, for instance, when you were driving on the highway?
In the beginning, I didn't want to get too many phone calls because it was just me. And then it was just one other employee. And so I was really worried about having too many people call and not returning phone calls because I heard that complaint over and over. So when I got my first Geekmobile, and I just put the Geek Squad logo on the side of the car. I didn't put a phone number on there. So driving around town in this 1958 Simca Aronde, which is an old French car, it looks like a Studebaker, and there's a picture of it on the internet, people would come up to me and saying, hey, I see your cars everywhere. And I only had one. So we started playing around with the idea of vehicles as advertising. And that's not gimmicky because we need those functionally for work. So I started having fun with the idea because it was a way I could have a kind of a valve to release business if I needed to get busier. I would just start driving around more, and I would also tell them, don't drive like 7 or 8 miles and over the speed limit like everybody else. Because if you in a 10-mile stretch, if you drive 62 into 55 like everybody else does, you only get the only 10 of the same cars are going to see you. But if you slow down to 57 miles an hour, 10 times the number of cars will see you, and you're driving the speed limit. Let people cut you off and thank them for it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Stevens, founder of Geek Squad. We'll hear more from Robert coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Robert Stevens, the founder and chief inspector of Geek Squad, a company that provides computer and entertainment center tech support for consumers and small businesses. Robert started the company in 1994 while he was still a college student at the University of Minnesota, and Geek Squad was bought by the consumer electronics giant Best Buy in 2002. In addition to driving more slowly and driving politely in traffic, you also had your car appear outside of an orchestra hall at some point, where the car was shown on the local CBS station. What was that story?
Who is my target audience? The target audience of the Geek Squad is anyone that owns or uses a computer. Well, that's pretty much everybody. So if everybody's a potential customer, who would I choose out of all of them to be my first choice in customers? Rich people. Where do rich people go? The opera. So I went to an orchestra hall in downtown Minneapolis, called him up and saying, what time's the opera get out? He's like, 9:05, sir. So at 9:06, I'd be doing laps around orchestra hall. And, you know, what happens is the rich people walk out in their fur coats waiting for their line of limousines to pick them up. And they're like ducks falling off a log. Okay, they roll into their limos. And by the time I do another lap around the building, another layer of rich people are going to get into their limos. And all they do is they just see my car pass by. I call that time release marketing. Because, you know, you may not have a computer problem now, but all I'm trying to do is get you to talk or remember me at some point. So sure enough, the phone starts ringing from the richer neighborhoods in town. And that didn't cost a dime. So anyway, the next week, I'm sitting there in front of Orchestra Hall, And it's like 5 minutes to nine, waiting for the opera to get out. And all of a sudden, my phone rings. You know, dude, you're on TV. Look to your left. And I look over, and there's a local CBS affiliate. You know, a lot of these towns now, you know, they've got the news anchor in the glass thing visible from the street. And sure enough, he's like, back up your car about 2 feet. Perfect. Your logo's right behind his head. And so now the dance begins, because now every night I'm parked across the street during the 9 and 10 o'clock newscasts. And even when they try and change the angles, I back my car up and move it back and forth. And they can't do anything about it. It's like those people on the Today Show that hold up the big placards, you know. It accomplished a business goal. We did it in a fun manner, and it didn't cost anything.
Let me see the bottom of your shoes.
So...
interesting. You have a Geek Squad imprint on the bottom of your shoe and your heel. Where did you come up with that idea?
Well, somebody walked into my office one day about 3 years ago and they said, okay, we're now approaching like 8,000 Geek Squad agents. We have so many shoes. We give everybody 2 pairs of shoes a year, you know, to rotate out or more. So that's 16,000 pairs of shoes. So... they're like, we can get our own shoes made now. Do you want the logo on the box? Do you want the box to be orange? And I thought back immediately to something I had seen 10 years ago. I was getting my picture taken for a magazine on the Santa Monica Pier, and I'm watching a tractor rake the sand on the beach there. And behind the rake was a big metal drum pressing a Coppertone ad into the sand. And I always remember that, going, wow, that's a really creative place to stick advertising. And in that moment, I was being told that you can produce your own shoes. I said, screw the box. Can they put our logo on the heel and in reverse? So I type in Google. I type in, how many steps a day does a human take? Do you know that humans take 7,000 steps a day?
Hmm.
Now, I don't have a calculator in my head right now, but take 17,000 agents of the Geek Squad times 7,000 steps a day times, let's say, 0.001% of the time. They're walking in snow, sand, or the muddy water before you go into the grocery store, and we happen to leave a few logos. And the point is, I can't tell you to this day how much revenue we've derived from that. And frankly, I don't care. I probably got more mileage out of the story than anything else. But it also sets in motion for the agents. We want you to think differently. There's always an opportunity right underneath your own feet to think about what impression you make, no pun intended. In fact, I just should use that line.
So in addition to making an impression with your shoes and with your car, you also had some time on Minnesota Public Radio in the early days when you were giving computer lessons on the air. How did that happen?
I think we did a house call for somebody that worked at public radio, and they said, God, this is a really nice person. They have a lot of great advice. And they had us on the show, and the phone line just lit up. I mean, the switchboard, every time we go on the radio, is packed because people call in for, like, tech support questions. We would always try and answer them, though, in non-technical manner. Again, keeping back to the simple and not kind of making technology intimidating.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Stevens, founder of Geek Squad, a company that provides computer and electronics tech support to consumers and small businesses. Robert started Geek Squad in 1994 when he was 24 years old, and the company was sold to Best Buy in 2002. I want to talk about the experience of making house calls. The voyeur in me wants to know what some of the homes looked like inside when you were making house calls. What were some things that surprised you about how people lived?
Well, we don't kiss and tell, so I couldn't ever discuss with you any specifics of any house calls. We're known for our discretion. The first thing that strikes you, if you were to become a Geek Squad agent and make house calls for 6 months to a year, is the surprising number of people who answer the door with no clothes on. You know, there's voyeurism and then there's exhibitionism. You know, some people that are heavy smokers, their computers reek like nicotine and, you know, they're not doing their computers any favor. Some people are messy. Some people are very neat and tidy. Like, for example, if I show up at your home and you're very meticulous and your bushes are trimmed exactly, I know that you probably want a lot of detail and you know very particularly what I'm going to do, when I'm going to be done, and how much it'll cost. other people are like, I'm going to be in the backyard gardening, call me when it's fixed. So you just kind of learn how to read that.
Now, incidentally, I had a computer problem a couple years ago where my fan broke, and so my computer would overheat. And I had a frozen olive bread in my freezer. And for 6 weeks, I would use that frozen olive bread as the coolant for my computer. I just put my computer on top of this big olive frozen roll, and it worked. What are some resourceful things you'll see customers doing to deal with the problems they have before you guys arrive, if any?
Well, before we've arrived, sometimes they call us and ask us, what can I do until you come? Like, for example, sometimes somebody's like, oh, I spilled a Coke on my keyboard. What do I do? And I need that keyboard working, and they don't have time to run out and get one. Tell them to put it in the dishwasher.
Sure. You tell them to put it in the dishwasher.
Yeah, you can actually put a keyboard in the dishwasher, face down. The hot water will dissolve the sugars in the soda pop, which make it sticky. And don't put it on hot, dry, though, otherwise it'll melt the keyboard. But then, if you let it dry properly, it'll work again. Another thing we do sometimes is if you've spilled some syrup on a circuit board, by pouring evaporating, rubbing alcohol on there, that will actually dissolve the stuff without ruining the circuit board. Putting a hard drive in a freezer. Sometimes hard drives actually stick if they sat for a while, or if a hard drive's having problems and it won't boot up and you can hear the clicking sound. If you put the hard drive in a freezer, that expansion and contraction of the temperature change just might move it just a few microns enough to get it working again. The other thing we tell people to do is like a 5-minute miracle. The 5-minute miracle is anytime you have a problem, the first thing you should do, even before you call us, is turn everything off, unplug everything, go get a cup of coffee, come back in 5 minutes, plug everything back in, and reboot and try again. And you'd be surprised. A lot of times we haven't waited for the computer to finish doing what it's doing, and that can cause more problems.
I want to switch to pricing now. There's an article in the New York Times recently by the business writer David Leonhardt, and he writes about the expert service problem. And that is when the person diagnosing the problem is also the person being paid to fix the problem. So, for instance, if your car is not working, you'll bring it to the car repair shop, and he's going to diagnose the problem and also charge you to fix it. And when you have those two things going on in one person, it could lead to their overcharging the customer. How do you deal with that in your pricing?
We offer flat rates. So none of our people are commissioned. So they don't make any more money, by the way, at the end of the day, if they've billed, $2,000 versus $1,000. I came up with this years ago when I was still in college and I started making house calls. I started out $25 an hour. And the funny thing happens when somebody calls. They really want to know three things. Can you fix it? When can you fix it? How much will it cost? So I can't tell you how many times in the beginning that I'd finish fixing your computer and I'd give you a bill for $125. It might take me 5 hours to fix it. And they go, $125? I never knew it was going to cost this much. I said, man, I told you it was $25. I thought it was just going to be $25. Okay. Or I didn't think it'd be above $75. So I thought, how do I get, and I remember I had to keep timesheets and all this other stuff. There are hidden administrative costs to complexity in business. People want flat rates, and it's very natural. I want to know what it's going to cost before I enter into this, so it's kind of a contract. Mm-hmm. Once I did that, it eliminated the need for timesheets, and also it eliminated customer disappointment. Customers were never surprised again when we showed up.
As you were growing the business from just yourself to one employee to 30 employees to now 20,000 employees, was there a piece of press or some type of catalyst that caused your company to experience a jolt in business in the early days?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, ultimately, your best press that you ever get is local newspaper or local coverage. It's the longest lasting. It generates the most direct business, because with national media, you get a lot of phone calls, but you don't get a lot of business. With local media, you get a lot of business. Like the Pioneer Press, in 1995, we got our first newspaper article about Geek Squad. And to this day, people in the Twin Cities still talk about that one article.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Stevens, founder of Geek Squad, a company that provides computer and electronics tech support to consumers and small businesses. Turning to your relationship with Best Buy, they bought you in 2002, but you first started working with them in some capacity in 1995. How did that happen?
Well, within the first year of starting Geek Squad, I had 3 or 4 employees. I knew this business was going to work, and I knew that we were going to be better than anybody else because most people in the service business aren't obsessive as I am, and that's just a fact. So I dare you to compete against me. So I thought, God, we should just go to Best Buy. I mean, most of our customers are coming from Best Buy. They're frustrated. A lot of the people I'm hiring used to work at a Best Buy, so I know they've got good people. They probably just haven't figured out that service is a profit center, not a cost center. I got called one day by somebody who said, "Hey, I've got a client, Best Buy. They're filming a computer commercial, and they need the Intel Inside logo to pop up on the screen during the commercial. How much do you charge for the day? We'll pay you $1,000 to sit there and make. All I had to do was bring a JPEG on a floppy disk to a photo shoot and make it come up, and they paid me $1,000. So I got to know some of the people at Best Buy at corporate, and I thought, these are pretty nice people. And so I always wanted to join forces with them, but I didn't at the time in 1995 because I didn't think Geek Squad's model had been perfected yet. I wanted to come up with a new web-based dispatch system and a lot of system improvements to further increase the quality. Finally, I kept growing the company as far as I could. I knew this business could not be franchised. I knew I could not do an IPO on my own because service needed. You need to be there when the product's sold if you're really going to sell a lot of service. That's a very key point. That's why there's never been a nationally branded technology support service, and there's not likely to be one our size for quite some time, if ever.
So what you're saying is if you provide that service or that promise of service when the person buys their iPod or their computer, then there's more of a chance for profit generation.
Yeah. So finally, I said if I IPO Geek Squad, Wall Street will tear me apart because we're never going to grow as fast as they like. I need to partner with somebody who needs to differentiate themselves. I need to partner with somebody who's not going to sell it in 2 years. And that's why I believe Geek Squad acquired Best Buy. I called them. I knocked on their door and I said, "Listen, most of the people that work for me used to work for you. I know you're a good company. You're a good Midwestern ethical-based company. And you sell a lot of fun stuff. You sell the stuff, I'm going to make it work." And they said, "Yeah, that's a pretty good idea. Let's do it." So we dated for a couple of years before we got married. And I guarantee you, in 10 years, Geek Squad will be larger than Best Buy because you don't have to buy it at Best Buy for Geek Squad to help you with it.
How does Brad Anderson, the CEO of Best Buy, feel about your saying that you acquired Best Buy versus Best Buy acquiring
You
you?
will find him correcting himself on CNBC or wherever else he's being interviewed. It's kind of like Letterman poking fun at Viacom, the parent company. Brad is very, very savvy to know that Geek Squad is one of the key strategic imperatives to differentiate Best Buy. Listen, you can buy a digital camera on eBay and a lot of other places besides Best Buy. The reason we think people are going to buy it at Best Buy is because you're not just getting a box anymore. I'll bring it to your home. Or if you want to buy it for your grandmother across the country, a Geek Squad agent will show up at the home, set it up at her pace, and show her how to auction off some of her stuff on eBay and keep her happy.
Now, as you're growing the business, you're now in China as well as Canada. How are you dealing with some of the cultural issues? What are some of the cultural issues you might face by being in China, for example?
Well, I guess you'd say there are two cultural issues. There's the literal culture that you go into, and like, and Chinese consumers have different buying patterns than Americans. But Geek Squad has been translated roughly into Magic Guest, which I
In
love
Mandarin.
in Mandarin. Magic Guest, which I love that name. In fact, I love it so much I've already registered MagicGuest.com. That's really what we are. We're a magic guest. But then there's the culture of the company as it grows in size. I get asked this all the time. Well, how do you maintain quality? Quality's an issue forever in every service company. It's like chasing a sunset. You're never done. It's like a marriage. Your marriage is never done. It's a constant work in progress. That's why service sucks in so many places, because at some point you have an executive who's not married to it. I'm married to Geek Squad. It's my baby. Even though I legally don't own it anymore, I now try and influence the big company to do the right thing.
Before you came to sit with me today, you had a couple hours on your hand and you actually followed some of your Geek Squad employees around. Explain that.
Well, we have kind of like a FedEx package tracking system. I had 3 hours to kill today while I was in New York, and I looked in the system and said, Where are some nearby? I mean, there are agents everywhere in North America. And so I found an agent a few blocks away that was due for a house call at 1:30 today. I waited outside the apartment building, and he showed up 5 minutes early. And I shook his hand and said hello. And I said, thank you for being part of the Geek Squad. Thank you for being on time. And I don't want to keep you long because I don't want to keep the customer waiting. Now,
did he know who you were?
Yeah, he recognized me immediately.
He was freaked out, I bet.
He was freaked out. And more importantly, this is important to me because I don't believe that a company has to sacrifice its quality and dilute its culture the larger it gets. He's going to tell every other agent in the Triborough area in the next month that I was there today and that I said, thank you for being. How often does an employer just thank an employee for being part of the company? But more importantly, he's going to communicate that. So I think you can be highly personal while being very large in geographic scale.
You talked before about service being a marriage. And speaking of marriage, you are married. When did you get married throughout this whole Geek Squad process?
Well, I married my college sweetheart 10 years late because I tried to marry her in actually 1994. And we had a tempestuous relationship at the time, so I fell madly in love in college. The first moment, the night the Gulf War started, was the first time I saw her. You know, she was a single mother at the time, putting herself through college, and didn't want to be go off the rails with me. I'm a rather passionate individual, and when I see something I want, I kind of go after it. So I had planned to propose marriage, and we broke up. And so I always say that the growth of Geek Squad is a direct result of my broken heart. So I threw myself into my work. And so when I thought I was going to expand Geek Squad to LA and move there forever and move away from Minneapolis, her ex-husband used to get his computer fixed all the time. So I would ask about her. And so I called him and I said, I think I'm going to move to Los Angeles and run Geek Squad from there. And I just want to say goodbye to Jackie. And so, and I haven't talked to her in years. So I called her up and we had lunch and we found out we both weren't married and fell madly in love again. And I finally married her in 2003. It's a testament to persistence. So, you know, Geek Squad really was my therapy for my great muse in my life.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Robert Stevens, founder and chief inspector of Geek Squad. Coming up, we'll meet Connie Duckworth, founder of Arzu, an organization that provides economic empowerment to women in Afghanistan. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder and pro bono president of Arzu, a nonprofit organization that aims to provide sustainable income to impoverished Afghan women. Arzu sources rugs from weavers in Afghanistan, sells them in the United States, and compensates these women at above-market rates. She started Arzu in 2003 after traveling to Afghanistan as a member of the U.S. Afghan Women's Council, a government-sponsored group that promotes private investment in Afghanistan. Prior to starting Arzu at the age of 51, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was the situation that you first encountered among impoverished women in Afghanistan when you visited there in 2002?
I felt like I was stepping back in time 2,000 years. Not only is it so different culturally, but it had been a country that was subject to almost 25 years of nonstop warfare. Kabul looked like Berlin after World War II, flattened rubble. And we went into a bombed-out school building. There were literally hundreds of women and children, widows and their children, living in this shelter. To the best of their ability, they had put plastic bags over some of the gaps in the windows. There was no furniture, no water, no sanitation, no cooking facilities, nothing. And these women were surviving the winter in this building. And I looked at them, and I couldn't help but thinking, that could be me. That could be any one of us, but for the quirk of fate of where we were born. I have to say, that was the tipping point. And I came back on the plane from that first trip saying, what can I do personally to try to make some difference?
What about citizenship? Is there a lack of formal citizenship among these women?
Well, since the fall of the Taliban, there has been a concerted international and national effort to basically include women in the future of Afghanistan. And before the various wars, before the invasion of the Russians, women did have an active role as citizens in Afghanistan. There was a constitution from the 60s. Women were professionals. And because it's a gender-segregated society, 50% of the physicians were women. So they played an active role. That was all, in effect, wiped away. And you have a generation of women with no education because the Taliban precluded women from leaving their homes.
It's interesting that this disenfranchisement of women is kind of a recent phenomenon. As you were saying, 50 years ago, they enjoyed, if not equal rights to men, better rights than existed during the Taliban era. And now we're getting back to some semblance of democracy to some extent. So you're on the plane coming back from Afghanistan to the United States thinking, okay, well, what can I do? What impact can I make? Why rugs?
Well, the first idea wasn't really rugs. I kind of backed into that idea. I see the world through a business lens because of my business background. And so I naturally think that the solution to most imminent problems is economic empowerment. So I thought jobs. We're going to get these women jobs because when a woman can earn a living, it's well documented, the first thing she'll do is educate her children and then lift the community as a whole. So not knowing much about Afghanistan, I naturally thought, well, let's open some factories. Garment factory, couple of issues with that. Gee, is there electricity? No. Can you provide security? No. Is there water? No. Well, another couple of problems, the women couldn't leave their homes to go to a factory to work. So what I rapidly learned was to retreat from that ill-thought-out idea. And the bottom line we came up with is that about the only thing that women could culturally do in an acceptable way was to work in their homes. And rugs have been made by women for millennia, often with the patterns passed down from mother to daughter, often woven by memory, although the rug industry had been extremely dislocated given all the years of war. And many of the patterns were being lost. But rugs were almost the default position. It can be done in a woman's home. She knows how to do it. And it was the highest margin product I could think of because the point of all this is to kick off cash.
And what was the reaction of some of these families or of these women whom you targeted?
We go to the village elders first, and we sit down and explain what Arzu is. And we get permission to work in the village. If the elders don't want us in the village, we go to a different village. We then go to the household level. We approach the patriarch first. And if the patriarch agrees that we can work with that family, we then speak to the women. So because, again, it's gender segregated, we have a staff that involves men and women. The men talk to the men and the women talk to the women.
You mentioned that you have male monitors and female monitors, and the men talk to the patriarchs in the family, and the women speak to the matriarchs in the family. Is there ever a problem with communication between them? Can the monitors talk to each other?
When we started our expansion into northern Afghanistan in the Turkmen area, we hired a young woman monitor and a young man. Well, we'd be getting these internet reports back. And we'd look at them, and there'd be these discrepancies. And we're like, what is wrong? Are they not talking to each other? Well, then we sort of said that facetiously. It turned out they weren't talking to each other. They weren't related. So therefore, they could not meet, even though they were both employed by our company, in a public place together. So we solved the problem by hiring the nephew of the woman, who also, oh, by the way, knew some computer skills, which was good. And then the three of them could meet.
Now, is this rule a vestige or a result of the Taliban rule, or is this part of the Muslim law? Where is this rule from that the men can't talk to the women?
It's really a vestige of traditional tribal customs. And it is a very religious country, so there's definitely an Islamic overlay. But the differences we see from conservative to more liberal is vast. Our area in Bamiyan, which is the central part of Afghanistan, is a very, quote, easy area for us to work in because the people there seem much more open-minded. So there we see a greater ability for men and women to be speaking together versus in the Andahoy region where religiously the people are more conservative.
So in a region like the Andahoy region, did you face resistance among families?
We did at the outset before we had any local reputation. We'd face families that would say no interest. And if a family didn't elect to work with us, we moved to a different household and a different family. But I will tell you, the first time we paid a bonus, because we pay a 50% quality cash bonus when the rug is completed, we were oversubscribed in that village the next day.
So those families who had resisted initially saw their neighbors getting a bonus and getting more income, and so then they signed up?
Yes. In Bamiyan, we had researched a couple of different villages to decide where we were going to start when we expanded into that area, and we selected one village. About 6 months later, we received a formal delegation of men from the other village with a written petition signed by all the elders, men and women, asking Arzu to come to their village.
You talk about men reaching out to you. Are there men weavers? Do some of the men want to weave?
It depends, again, on the tribe. If it's traditional that the men weave, we allow them to weave. We always have a master weaver, though, who is the woman.
And is there ever resentment among some of the men in these communities that the women are getting income and gaining empowerment?
Not so much within the family itself, but we have had situations where some of the middlemen that Arzu is disintermediating, we've had men who were paying women subpar rates to weave, badmouth us and go around and tell other villagers that, you know, you can't trust Arzu, don't weave for them, they don't know what they're doing.
Has your security ever felt compromised when you were there?
We have taken the approach that we want to be as local as possible and as invisible of an organization as possible on the ground. From time to time, when violence kicks up, there'll be periodic spates of suicide bombings, etc. We try to monitor this random violence as much as possible, but if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, it's a problem.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder of Arzu, an organization that connects female weavers in Afghanistan with rug buyers in the United States. She started Arzu in 2003 after traveling to Afghanistan as a member of the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council, a government-sponsored group that promotes private investment in Afghanistan. Prior to starting Arzu at the age of 51, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs. I want to talk about the economics of these rugs. How much do they sell for in the United States? What's the range?
The range, depending on size and pattern, of course, is between roughly $1,000 and $15,000.
How much is the weaver seeing?
There's a going labor rate for weaving rugs. So we'll pay the high end of the market rate plus 50% of that. Normally, a woman would go into debt to purchase materials that she would then use her labor to weave the rug. And then she'd turn the rug over to someone else who would charge her to finish the rug and then would go sell it. And at the end of the process would come back and say, here's your money. What we've done is we provide the highest quality materials. We've also systematically gone through and replaced looms or provided looms. A loom is, in effect, her biggest capital asset, and I'd say maybe one or two out of 100 weavers might have actually owned a loom. What we, in effect, are doing is taking her from a risk position as an entrepreneur and converting her into a salaried employee so that she has a dependable income that we pay not at the end of the process, but throughout the process. So she can put food on the table today.
You also are supplying other benefits to these women and their families, such as health care and education. Can you describe that a little bit?
That's the literacy classes that we're establishing in the village. That's the basic access to health care. It's transportation to clinics and hospitals for pregnant women. We've built a school in one village. We've looked at water catchment systems, and we're undertaking the construction of one of those because water is a very big area. We've been researching alternative livelihood. What that really means is jobs for men in the village. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at some small food processing plants. All of the proceeds from the sale of rugs here goes to support the entire closed-loop Arzu system. So all of the money from a particular sale does not go directly to a particular woman, but funds all of the projects.
What's an example of a woman who has benefited from Arzu?
So one of our earliest weavers was a widow named Hamida. And Hamida happens to have two daughters who are the ages of my two daughters. Hamida was a widow. She was a refugee in Pakistan, suffered greatly, and she started weaving for Arzu. When Hamida, a year after starting our literacy classes, and everyone, when we started literacy classes, was in grade one. Didn't matter if you were 50 or 12 or 25. She said, learning to read was like a blind woman getting her eyes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder and president of Arzu. Prior to starting Arzu, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs, where she worked for over 20 years. Connie is also the author of The Old Girls Network, a book for female entrepreneurs and businesswomen. How did you raise capital for Arzu?
Well, I funded the first 18 months personally. We'll call that friends and family money. Then we applied for a seed grant from USAID, the Agency for International Development. USAID invested over a three-year period a total of $2 million.
How does one find an Arzu rug?
Well, the best place to go is to our website, which is arzurugs.org. And Arzu, by the way, means hope in Dari, and it's also a common woman's name. Dari is one of the many tribal languages in Afghanistan.
So I want to talk about your prior professional history. You were at Goldman Sachs for 20 years.
That's right.
But while you were at Goldman, you led kind of an entrepreneurial life to some degree within Goldman Sachs. What is an example of a project that you started within Goldman?
Well, I was tapped in 1990 probably by Bob Rubin to start a diversity initiative. Now, sitting here today in 2007, you think, well, what's so novel about that? At the time, that was not a word that was widely utilized, certainly not in Wall Street, but anywhere in corporate America. It was an undefined term. And so I was told to start this, and I had no idea what this was. But over the next 5 years, we basically implemented all of the family-friendly type policies, job sharing. We had the first daycare backup center in Wall Street in New York, where people whose child care fell through could bring their child, man or woman, bring their child for the day. Maternity, adoption leave. So really all of the kinds of policies that help improve the workplace and the work environment.
You mentioned that Bob Rubin came to you. He became later the Secretary of Treasury during the Clinton administration. I've heard that he said, "I hear you can get things done." Why did you have that reputation at Goldman, do you think, for getting things done?
Well, I think it comes from having grown up in the bond department, which is for those who ever read Liar's Poker, that book from the 80s, it was very much transaction-based. And so we were trading hundreds of millions of dollars of securities in a single trade at a single moment. And so execution was paramount.
Now, in addition to word of mouth and having people just go to your website to buy the rugs, you've also had cocktail parties at Goldman Sachs, for example, where you have all women of all ages come and buy these rugs.
Oh, yes. The firm has been very supportive and also is the proud owner of some Arzu rugs for the executive floors. One of the benefits of having a long business career is that it gives me a good Rolodex, and I have been quite shameless in levering that Rolodex to ask people for help.
after you left Goldman, in addition to starting Arzu, you also wrote a book called The Old Girls Network, which tries to help women entrepreneurs and women in corporate America kind of deal in a man's world. What were some of the issues that you faced being a woman at Goldman Sachs?
When I first got out of business school and was even applying for jobs, I was still being told, now this is ancient history, but in the late 70s by some of the companies that I interviewed with that, well, we don't hire women. Now, you definitely wouldn't hear that one today, but I would say basically I've typically been the only woman in the room. And now I sit, from a business perspective, I sit on several corporate boards. And that seems to now be, at least in popular press, one of the last bastions of male-dominated business arenas.
It's striking to me, and this might seem ridiculous at first, the similarities almost between the women you're trying to empower in Afghanistan and the women you've tried to promote here in the United States, whether it's through your book or through Goldman, just this notion of financial independence.
I think that's a very interesting observation, because I do very much see the linkage. I have come to believe over the course of my career that there's a dignity that comes with work. I think that, and I see it in Afghanistan, I think the right to work and to have a value placed on your work is really a basic human need and a basic human right.
In your book, I was struck, there was a female pioneer venture capitalist receiving an award, and she comes up on stage onto the podium to receive the reward, and she said, "Does this microphone work for women too?"
I have a little personal saying, which is, "She who writes the check controls the agenda." And I think that's true in politics. I think it's true in business. I think it's true in every venue.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Connie Duckworth, the founder of Arzu. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.